Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Give me a follow-up when you get a sec. Instagram.com/Kevin Rose. Not that you would ever go to the website. Just use the app and search for Kevin Rose and give me a follow. I'm posting right now. I'm doing some vitamin D experiments where I'm actually using lights that put off UVB rays to create vitamin D naturally in the body, since I'm up in Oregon and we're not getting any UVB exposure right now. So this is a way for me to not take supplements, but actually do it the natural way. So this is one of the stupid things that I do that I actually document for you to watch. Anyway, Trey Ratcliffe reached out to me here about, I don't know, maybe a year ago, and said, hey, just wanted to let you know I've created this beautiful kind of video series, or not video, but short film that highlights some of the talks that were given by Alan Watts. I'm going to link this up in the show notes because you have to go and watch this. Alan Watts is a philosopher that I absolutely love, and I think he's one of the philosophers that was really famous for bringing a lot of Eastern teachings to the West. And he has this like beautiful British accent, and he put together this video, and I found it so compelling that I actually put it in my meditation app, Oak, that people could then click on and watch it. Anyway, that was my first kind of like introduction to Trey. I knew who he was because he was insanely famous on Google+. So when I was at Google, and I remember he was like one of the most followed people on Google+, with just millions of followers, because of his photography. And his photography is just, it's top notch. It's insane. Trey, the unique thing about him is that he wasn't a photographer until much later in life. He didn't pick up a camera until he was into his 30s. And so he's one of these guys that decided to pick up a camera and then figured out how to use command line techniques. I don't want to spoil it. I really want you to hear how he got started, how he was able to engineer his way into creating these really beautiful photos that were unique and no one was doing at the time. And now his photos are insanely collectible. His prints alone can fetch over $100,000 a print. And he has a new book that he's coming out with where he's talking about how to build a social media following, and also highlighting really how a lot of people are faking their way into buying followers and buying comments and buying likes and things like that. Trey is an amazing human. He's such a sweet person. One of those types of people that, you know, I met him for the first time, like just gives you a big hug when he meets you. Just a gentle, kind soul, which I really love. People that are like that, just, you know, they're at their core, they're just good humans. And, he's certainly one of those. So I had a lot of fun. It was my pleasure to have him come out and visit me in Portland, Oregon. And we got to hang out and talk about all things life and philosophy. And I actually did his podcast as well, which should be up. So if you want to see us walking through the woods, and he had this crazy 360-degree camera that captured our walk through the woods, and you can actually pan around and hear us just talk about life. It was a really fun podcast to do, his show as well. So I will link to that in the show notes. But yeah, I hope you enjoy it. This is Trey Ratcliffe. Dude, Trey, thank you for coming on the show, man.
Hey, I am excited. I've always, you know, liked you from afar and kind of like, you know, been a fan and kind of, you know, watched everything that you do. And, you know, the chance to hang out for the last 24 hours has been great. And
it's cool to have you here in Portland. It's awesome.
Yeah, I've never really spent any time here, and it's been it's fantastic. What a cool city.
Yeah, it's a fun city. There's a lot of good food. The weather's been fun. We have a hike that we did yesterday with your 360-degree camera. Tell us about that camera, because it's really cool. You're doing this series where you take people out. I mean, I guess the only other one I saw was on a nature trail as well. What's the idea behind it?
Well, I came up with this kind of loony idea. I did the Camino Santiago with Kevin Kelly and Matt Mullenweg and a bunch of these ne'er-do-wells. And we kind of had this rule that we were only going to talk about philosophy and science for this entire 7-day trek. And I thought, man, these guys are so clever and fun. We should capture some of these conversations. But what's a cool way to do it? And so I found this 360 camera. The newest one is called the Insta360 X1. And records in 5.7K in 360. It's a small little thing. It's about the size of an iPhone. And one of the coolest things about it is that you put it on this little selfie stick and extend it out. And when it stitches together the video, it erases a selfie stick. So it looks like this orb is just floating out in front of you.
Yeah, it's crazy. When you showed me the footage, I was like kind of clicking around. The cool thing is you can kind of investigate anything that you want. So if like you're walking down a trail and I see something off to the left, I can then like click and drag and see that object and like go around in 360. But I thought you were like, I'm going to bring this thing to Portland. I thought you were going to be wearing some like massive backpack with like some kind of like camera over the top of your head or something.
Right, like those Google guys.
Yeah, it's not that at all, though. It's pretty awesome. So yeah, we did one yesterday, which is cool.
Yeah, it was really nice because, you know, people can move the camera around if they get tired of looking at us. They can look at this beautiful forest we're walking through. And, you know, I think it's a nice chance to talk about, you know, we talk about vulnerability and so many different things, you know, the kind of, you know, conversations that I think are interesting and can help inspire people. And of course, it's the same kind of stuff you do on your podcast here.
Where do you release these?
I release them on YouTube. And then I put them on my blog and spread them across social media so people get to see them. Yeah, I think it's kind of an interesting format. And also, I kind of like this idea of walking and talking.
Yeah.
You know, there is something that's extra stimulating about just a couple of people walking through nature. And it kind of refreshes your mind. I know we were talking about this. We're both fans of Japan. And in Japan, people spend as much time in nature as possible. And there's sort of a cleansing there. I notice whenever I have any kind of even anxiety, just sitting in my studio working on photos or whatever, if I just go outside and walk around in nature for 5 or 10 minutes, it's impossible to have anxiety while walking around nature.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like for me, that's one of the big draws to Oregon is I just love the idea that if I'm heads down working on something or, you know, getting anxious around a product release or something, I just literally go outside and I'm like, smell the amazing woods and trees. And the Japanese have they call it forest bathing, where they've done studies on this, where they show that if you go and spend time in the forest, you actually drop your levels of cortisol, which is a stress hormone, and inflammation markers go down. I mean, there's a lot of really positive things just by being in the woods, which is awesome. So I think you're onto something.
I believe it. I think that's why Japanese people, especially out in nature, they just seem serene. They have a nice serenity to them, a calmness.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that chime forest. You mentioned that yesterday to me.
Yeah, I'm always looking for new places to go to Japan. I've been there maybe 9 or 10 times, and someone turned me on to two places. One is this wind chime forest, where you know people just sang wind chimes through this forest. It's this beautiful kind of sonic and visual experience. And the other, have you heard of this town where everybody has died, and when they die, they replace them with life-size puppets?
I have not heard of... This is the town? This isn't the place, the forest, where people go to kill themselves?
No.
Okay, that's different.
No, this is different. I forgot the name of it. I'll send it to you, but there's a lot of pictures of this place. It's really creepy, but kind of Japanese, and they redress all the puppets in the actual clothes of the people that die.
Wow.
And they're like sitting in cafes, and guys are delivering mail. People are sitting on park benches with their loved ones all dressed up.
How many of these things are there?
Hundreds.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that.
Well, it's just one of those quirky Japanese things that we love so much. You know?
Yeah, that's the thing about Japan is it's so quirky in so many ways. I remember seeing an article where people were up in arms like maybe a year and a half ago, where somebody decided to do an ice skating rink out there, where they actually thought it would be interesting to freeze live fish underneath the ice skating rink. So when you're skating around, you're like skating over like frozen fish.
Right.
It was just like only in Japan, man. That's the cool thing about it is it's just like you feel there's so many places we travel to where we just feel like, I mean, traveling is always fun and it's always unique and different every culture that you visit and every place that you go. But I tend to like the extremes. Like where you go to some place when you're like, I'm not at home right now. This is very, very different, you know, versus just flying to London or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's great to open your mind to new experiences because as you get these unusual, you know, audio visual inputs, it kind of rearranges your brain.
Yeah.
And there's been all these studies that the more open you are to new experiences, it accidentally makes you a more creative and open person.
Yeah.
And I think that's generally good for the world. I think this is why travel is good for everyone. I know when I really got into travel photography, slowly, it made me a more gentle person.
Yeah.
And you know, when you meet travelers that they're just, you know, chilled out, cruisy kind of people. And it really can soften the hard edges that your own particular culture that you grew up in might have created.
Oh, for sure, man. So, I mean, I was raised, my family was a hardcore Republicans, and there's not that there's anything wrong with Republicans. There's certain aspects of what they do that I can appreciate, but we were very much like America, like don't leave the country. Like there was never any discussion of an international trip or anything like that. And I noticed when I didn't get out of the country until I was like, you know, 23 or something like that for the first time. And I remember going to London and I went to Paris and it gave me, I don't know, the world just felt bigger mm-hmm. after I did that. And then all of a sudden I had compassion for a whole nother group of people. I remember like when, you know, there was terrorism going on in Paris and you did like, oh gosh, I've been there. Like I feel bad for those people. Mm-hmm. And like, you just don't have that. Had you not traveled?
Mm.
And that's happened every place that I've gone. I don't know. I just feel more connected to the earth or to the world as a kind of one big place versus just all about the United States.
Well, that's for sure. It's definitely a bubble within a bubble here.
Yeah,
that's
for sure.
Part of the reason I moved to New Zealand about 6 years ago with my family. I'm not anti-America or anything. I just know the world is a big and wonderful place. And every year I try to take my wife and my kids, who are now 10, 13, and 17, on a around the world trip to kind of sensitize them to the world. And, you know, I'm atheist. We're all atheist. And, but I think it's important and interesting to know the world's religions. So a couple of years ago, we did kind of a tour of the world religions that we spent about 10 days on a train in India, going through these very remote places. And we got to know all of the, you know, Hindu gods and all of their powers and, all of the belief systems around there. And we got to see how people are really into their own gods and how it's, you know, generally just a very peaceful, awesome thing. And it is a template to get through life. I probably overvalue my lack of a template with atheism. But some of these templates aren't so bad. And they're interesting in their own kind of sociological way. And then we went to the Middle East, where actually my wife was still a little afraid to go, you know, even yeah. though she's, you know, pretty well traveled. She's like, I don't know. Should we take our kids there? Is it
where
safe?
Did you go?
We went to Qatar and Oman.
Super safe.
Yeah, these are both great, but I've been all over. They're all pretty safe. And actually, Omanese people might be the nicest people in the world next to the Japanese. Mm-hmm. I was amazed. And so we visited mosques and, you know, learned about Allah and Islam. And we went into all these different places that people would sing. And it was really interesting for them to learn. So they got to juxtapose, you know, Hinduism and Islam. And then we went to Italy, went to the Vatican City, learned all about Catholicism and, you know, Christianity, this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they don't really have, you know, the total, you know, theological faculties to compare and contrast all these things. But it was a little bit of an entree, an amuse-bouche into the world religions and how so many people believe different things. It's not necessarily bad. But it was sort of a nice way for them to become more sensitive to what's going on around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Gosh, we've been all over the place already with this podcast. I want to start though, actually, and get at your kind of professional roots. The thing that I'm most fascinated, I'm sure I've recorded a podcast intro before this, so people know more about you. But the one thing that I was blown away by last night when we were chatting is that you picked up your first camera just 12 years ago. Is that right?
That's right. Right now I'm a tender 47 and I got my first camera when I was 35.
That's insane. Most people think of these like professional photographers and people that are really famous in this world like you are as something where, oh, I've been shooting for, you know, the last 30 plus years. And but that's just not the case with you. Like you, give me the, why did you pick up a camera? Why did you get started? Like what happened?
My background is computer science and math. That was what my degree is in. And I worked for Anderson Consulting and did lots of IT stuff and some startups. And I was really kind of into the IT world. I was really kind of a terrible programmer. And I kind of knew it wasn't for me because I would hang out with incredible programmers. I was like, man, these guys are meant to do this. And there's always kind of this gentle throbbing in the back of my head, like you're meant to do something else. You're meant to do something else. And I was going to visit a studio of ours. We're building games in Kuala Lumpur. So I started travel. I thought, man, traveling is pretty cool. These other cultures are interesting. What's going on? And then I was thinking like, man, these cities are beautiful. Everything's different. You know, like you're talking about with Japan, it's sort of like a parallel universe. You see how things are a little different than where mm-hmm. you grew up. And I thought, I should get a camera or something. So I got a good Nikon I'll never forget it. There was this beautiful sunset in Kuala Lumpur. And I was so excited. I took a photo of it because, like, this is a moment. I, you know, I'm having a moment with nature or the city, or I don't know what's happening. This was very inchoate in my understanding of my interaction with the world around me, especially the visual world. And so I took a photo, and my photo was total shit. It was totally ugly, banal, and boring. And it made me angry. I was like, how can this sunset and the world be so incredible, but this photo be so bad? And that anger isn't really the right word, but it made me like really upset. And I started really digging into it. You know, I kind of put on my computer science hat, my analysis hat, because it's a digital camera. I was like, what's happening with the sensor? How does it compare to the human retina? Is the retina a lot more sensitive? Turns out it is a lot more sensitive. It can see about 11 to 13 stops of light, where a sensor can only see like a few stops of light. So what can I do? And I started digging around, looking at algorithms and code I could use to reprocess this little ball of data I had.
So you didn't even think, I'll just take this into Photoshop and like do some sliders and see what happens with the photo. You were like, I want to write code to make this better.
Yeah. I was like, what kind of algorithms are out there that are better than, you know, because all this stuff seemed very standardized. That's what other photographers tended to use. And so I came into it with no training. You know, I never took a class or read a book. And of course, now I can look back and connect the dots. This is why it was so successful, because I didn't do things normal photographers did. Mm. And I found these really cool algorithms that NASA was using. I think they were stored on the MIT website for processing photos from Mars, because they would get these raw photos back from these rover cameras. And they wanted to see like what's in the atmosphere, what kind of minerals are in that rock, and really enhance these photos. So that what happens if you run these algorithms on a sunset photo? This was all like command line stuff. You know, there was no GUI or anything.
Crazy.
So you'd have all these dash commands, and I had to figure it all out, but I did, and I ran it. It was fascinating. I was like, wow, maybe this is what's happening. There's this area between your retina and your cortex called the retinex that does this interpretation of the light and the world around you. It's constantly interpreting this and building a patchwork quilt of the visual reality. And I thought, this is what this is doing. It's called tone mapping. And so immediately, so excited, I started a blog and I started doing things that no other photographers did, but I didn't really know this, and many taboo things. It was still quite taboo to process your photos. Then this is not what a pure photographer does. Like a real photographer gets a right in the camera, you know, supposedly. This is what they say. Also, every day I would share full res photos with no watermarks. I did everything Creative Commons, non-commercial.
Wow. Yeah. Back then, everybody was like really guarding their photos.
Right. They would post a little 640 by 480 photo with a giant watermark on it. And so I was producing really interesting high-res content from all around the world where I was traveling. And, you know, Creative Commons, the only thing is like, guys, everyone use it. Please use it. And just point back to my website. It's stuck in customs. So then we started to grow quite big because I was the only one doing it. And then I started writing like these really detailed free tutorials on how everyone can do it. And again, this is something photographers didn't do. People, maybe you don't remember, but like now there's tutorials on everything on YouTube.
Right.
It wasn't like this. There wasn't even a YouTube then, right? No one, especially photographers or people of certain crafts, would tell other people how they did it. You had to go to these gatekeepers of, you know, photography colleges where you would go for 4 years to unlock the secrets from these people that would hold information behind these brick walls. You know, that's how things used to be. But I always thought that was ridiculous. It just didn't make intrinsic sense. And what made intrinsic human sense to me is the same thing that children do, is I think we're here on Earth to create and share. And it's not a zero-sum game. And this was abundantly true to me from the very beginning. And that's kind of what drove the website and what I did. And I guess that's how I became popular.
Yeah. I mean, you've blown up. So what was that? When did you first realize that? Well, I guess there's a transition that had to happen at some point where people are coming to you for information. So you have people that are coming and saying, okay, I'm learning something here. But then all of a sudden, you know, people are collecting your stuff. Like, when did you decide to say, okay, I'm going to start selling prints and turn this into a business?
Yeah, so the website was always tricking along and making good money with advertising and affiliate stuff. And that was, you know, kind of fun and kind of a web kind of thing. But then, you know, I had a big following back in the Google Plus days. When that was part of the equation, it reached over like 15 million followers. Now that they're gone, lost 8 million there. So still at about 5 million. So it's a huge set of followings. I love them. I don't even call them fans. I just call them friends. I haven't gotten to know yet. But when you have this bell curve of people, there's on the edge of the bell curve are some wealthy people, right? And they enjoy the photos. It makes them happy and they wanted them in their house. So I decided to do extremely limited edition prints of only three. So I took 21 of my, you know, best classic works that I've done. And we made these limited editions, so only three prints of each one. And they're quite big. They can range anywhere from 6 feet across to 10 feet across. So they're kind of like big showpieces. A lot of them are made out of panoramas of 130 photos or 250 photos. So they kind of have this walk-up detail. And so we started selling them. And a lot of them started selling out. And the collectors all around the world have been very happy because, you know, once they're sold out, then they start to accumulate in value. We get new offers at higher prices. I don't get that. That's called the secondary market. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot of this, actually. There's this great book. I don't get the name wrong. It's called like the $15 million stuffed shark. There's this shark that Damien Hirst made. He got a shark in Australia. He suspended in formaldehyde. And it started selling kind of low, but now it's worth like $15, $20, $25 million. Like, how is a shark worth that much? And so by following some of these techniques, I did the same thing with the prints. It's just extremely limited edition. Because in a world where there's an infinite amount of everything, really people want what is rare. Because there's a story around it. It brings them joy. Not because they're special or anything. It's just like they found something in their life, almost like a relationship. Like a good relationship is so rare. There's not an infinite amount of good relationships. That's why you're so happy with a good relationship. Mm-hmm. And they do kind of form a relationship with a piece of art. It's a kind of interesting mind twist, but it's true. And the end all of it is it does bring people pleasure and it's valuable. And that's what people enjoy collecting.
How do you figure out how to price something like this? Like when you're, cause like if I was in your shoes and I'm doing these prints, I'd be like, okay, $1,000 a piece. Like did you do any testing the waters first? Did you look at other similar artists with, you know, that were doing prints than what they're charging?
I did a little bit of research, and as far as I could tell, no one was going to do exactly what I was going to do. You know, Peter Lick has these galleries all over, and he sells hundreds of his prints, and he keeps accumulating, and it goes up a little bit in price. And their technique is a little salesy. You know, you go in, and a salesman comes over, and they get your email, they follow up with you, and they a little bit of a pressure tactic. And I'm not like that. I'm more of a soft sell kind of guy. And also, I looked into the resale market for his stuff, and almost has like no resale, like. Which isn't good. You know, I think it's a little disingenuous to tell people that it's, you know, growing in value when it doesn't. When you have hundreds of these prints out there, they just don't really grow. So we have two series. Series one is 21 works. Those range in price from $75,000 to $95,000. So prints number one and two are $75,000. The print number three is $95,000, kind of the last scene on the plane. So people are incentivized to get one of the first two.
Sure.
And then immediately when the third one is sold, it's sold out. And we continue to get offers. Like, for example, there's an NFL player who's you know, also into photography and this kind of stuff. He bought one of the pieces, and that's now it's sold out at $95,000. But now we get offers, you know, at almost twice that. And so he has the option to resell it or just keep it on his wall. And let it give him and his family pleasure.
That's crazy. So that's kind of a really cool loop that you, because you're also saying, because most things that you buy that are collectible, and I have some experience in this on the kind of like vintage watch side of things with my involvement with Hodinkee, and it's like, you know, most times when you buy something collectible, it's on you to resell it later. You have to go to Christie's or Sotheby's or someone like that. You're saying that someone will come to you and say, actually, I want to pay more for this. And then you reach back out to the current collectors, the people that own them, and make them that offer. And you don't get any of that upside at all.
No. So I reach out and say, hey guys, someone has offered, you know, $150,000. I know you guys all love the print. It's an option for you. Let me know. And right, I don't get any of that upside, but it's great for them.
Yeah.
And hopefully they're happy, and maybe they'll come back and buy more prints, you know, because it was a good investment. They had fun with it on their walls for a few years. And also, I like the concept of swapping art out every few years, because sometimes people put art up and it stays there for like 20 years until their grandkids, you know, take over the house. Because I think we've kind of gotten used to this idea of like screensavers changing and backgrounds and like having a dynamic visual environment around us. And sometimes it's hard to decide what you want to look at, so you can have multiple things. So one thing we discovered, I don't know if it was a mistake with Series 1, is that the prints are so big, 6 feet across to 10 feet across. Not everyone has walls like that. And that tends to be a little bit of the uber wealthy kind of situation. So then we wanted to, you know, go a little bit more down the bell curve. And Series 2 is more accessible. You know, these range anywhere from 3 or 4 feet across to about 7 feet across. And they start at $15,000 and go up to about $65,000. And that's a series of five. So in this way, we're able to satisfy like a bigger chunk of the bell curve. I think we probably won't go a lot lower than that. But I think it seems to work really well, makes people happy, and it doesn't, you know, dilute the market, which is probably one of the worst things you can do for something that's unique.
Yeah, absolutely. So where do you, the thing that we went over yesterday that I thought was really cool is you're writing a new book that is focused on kind of building a social media following. Can you give me the title of that book? Because I thought that was an awesome title.
Sure. Well, first, let me tell you, as you know, I'm a Zen guy. I don't take myself seriously in the least. In fact, I think the greatest creative gift that anyone can give to themselves is to let go of themselves. And this is really the core of the book. I almost called the book How to Stay Zen on Social Media. But I decided to use a much more clickbaity name, okay, because I want to, we talked a little bit about this on our walk yesterday. Like, there's the bulk of the bell curve, right? My overall raison d'etre, my modus operandi, is to bring as much consciousness to the world as possible. I know this sounds very solipsistic, and I don't mean it like that. I just think it's a good mission. And you kind of have this, like, of the 8 billion people on Earth, or, the 500 million people in the U.S., you have this bell curve of consciousness. And there's a lot of people in the middle that are not getting it, right? They're unconscious. They're full of anxiety, a lot of problems in their life. And I think if we can just crack open the door to consciousness on these people, it will be better for them. It'll be better for the world. And I think that all around the world, not just with the U.S. So this is why I have this big buildup to why I have this clickbaity title, because I want to get them in.
Sure.
And get them interested in the subject matter. And then say, hey guys, there's another path. You don't have to have this unconscious activity on social media that causes more and more anxiety in you and other people. Anyway, having said that, here's the name of the book, possibly the longest book title in the history of books. It's called Under the Influence: How to Fake Your Way into Getting Rich on Instagram. Subtitle is Influencer Fraud, Ego, Anxiety, Selfies, and Mass Delusional Behavior.
That's a pretty impressive title. There's a lot to unpack there.
There is. And I think sometimes, you know, when you look at like a BuzzFeed article or all this stuff, you know, that gets spread around, sometimes the only chance you have to advertise a book is the book title. So I might as well cram it full of all these catchphrases that'll get people interested.
Yeah. The cool thing about, well, this has to be a really tough thing for you personally, because you are a very Zen person that doesn't seem to care about things such as, you know, I mean, you have massive amounts of followers in the millions, but you also, on one hand, really don't care about that. Like, it's not about how can I get to the next, you know, 20 million followers or whatever it may be. There are lots of people out there that want to build a brand, which you are very good at, obviously. How do you figure out, you know, how to have a business and build a brand and do this on Instagram? And, you know, kind of like you highlight in the book some things that are done right and some things that are done wrong. What's your take on this as someone that relies upon some of this to some extent for their own profession, but also sees it as like something that could be potentially negative as well?
Yes, that was yet another impetus for writing the book, because I know lots of people that have small businesses and they're trying to be successful on Instagram and they feel hopeless. Mm-hmm. You know, they see other people out there supposedly having success. You know, of course, in the book, I have a few examples of how a lot of it is just outright fraud. I show examples of how a lot of people are buying followers, buying comments, and buying likes. And it creates sort of a false economy. And it does make a lot of people hopeless. Like, I can't get that popular. What's going on?
But isn't it a thing where it helps to some extent? Like, for example, in your book, you talk about how people buy the blue check mark on Instagram. And, you know, there's something about a blue check mark that adds this sense of, oh, they must have been vetted by someone. I can trust them more. Maybe this is a quality product. So I can see why people would want to go and find a way, whether they have to pay for it or not, to get that as early as possible, whether they actually, you know, quote unquote, deserve it or not. So, you know, how do you figure out what is worth paying for? You know, like that same thing with followers. Followers mean something, even though they could be fake accounts. I guess it's really what's the intention behind the account.
There's two levels of people that buy followers. One is just sort of a weird egoic reason that they want their friends to think that they're popular, this sort of thing. The other one, which I definitely feel is more fraudulent, is let's say you buy hundreds of thousands of followers. And we did this with a fake account.
Talk to me about that fake account. Walk me through this whole thing. It's fascinating.
Yeah. And the purpose of it was to show this more serious case of fraud where you buy hundreds of thousands of followers, fake comments, fake likes. And these are all run on scripts. None of it's real. And then you trade that for real life business deals. You know, people trade this for, you know, free Prada bags, for cars, for free trips to resorts and, all, you know, all kinds of stuff. It's actually last year, $2 billion was spent on influencer marketing and it's going to grow to $10 billion. So it's becoming a serious thing and marketers don't know what's real and what's not real. And so to that effect, we built a fake account. I had this good looking accountant named assistant named Tane, and we took a bunch of photos of him and we had like a test account and a control account to see which one would grow. I knew ahead of time. So in about a month, we bought him 104,000 followers.
How much did that cost you?
Oh, probably a couple hundred bucks.
That's crazy. Does PayPal these people? Like walk people? How does this actually happen for people that have never, you know, experienced this before?
Yeah, we lay it all out there in the book and we show all the different services that we use. There's hundreds of services to use. And apparently the sketchier the service, the cheaper it is and the faster it is. You know, we got like, I think 50,000 followers in just a couple of days. And then you can also buy comments, like you can buy really cheap comments, which are just random emojis and random words. Or you can like write your own comments, like in a spreadsheet.
Oh,
and
wow.
They'll be randomly distributed. So they look like they're really like supporting a product or supporting the person or...
Oh, crazy. Yeah. So I could go in and say, let's just say I'm going to plug something out there. I could write 500 comments in a spreadsheet that are all unique.
Right.
That are all positive and actually framed in the language that I want presented.
Right.
And then these people will all come and leave those specific comments.
Absolutely. You'll get these random comments from all these people and you say like, I want, you know, 150 comments of my own custom comments spread randomly among these 7 photos. And then in turn, of course, what you do is that you would go to a brand or an agency and say, look at me, look how awesome I am. You should really work with me. You know, let's do a trip to the Bahamas, pay me $50,000. I want business class tickets and I want free food and alcohol and rooms. And people do this kind of stuff all the time. That's just one example. There's, you know, there's the fashion industry, there's the beauty industry. And actually in there, it's very difficult to see who is doing this. You have to do either deep dives or there's another site that you can look at that shows historical growth. Because if you just look at someone and they have 500,000 followers, it's hard to tell if they're real or not. The only way to really tell is to look at their historical growth. And if you see it has this sort of statistical staccato rhythm, and you can see days on which they buy, then it's very obvious. But no one knows how to do this research. As far as I can tell, most agencies don't know how to do it. Most brands are too busy to do a deep dive on these people. And it's just the Wild West out there. And this is the thing, is that it's injurious to all the real people, the small businesses that are trying to grow on Instagram. The other thing that is, I think, bad from Instagram's point of view, although they tend to ignore this, because yes, the cynical side, yes, Instagram just wants big numbers and all this kind of stuff for stock and this sort of thing. But I think ultimately it's injurious to them because they have a lot of counterfeit currency in the economy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know if you've read Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari.
Oh, I want to. I haven't
yet. It's great. Well, he's got so many wonderful concepts in there, but one of them is that humans are successful. We're the most successful animal on the planet because we all collectively believe in a fiction. For example, a meter. A meter doesn't exist. You can't see it or touch it, but we all agree on what a meter is, so we can make agreements with strangers. Same thing with an hour. You can't see or touch an hour, but it made it convenient for us to meet for lunch yesterday at 1 p.m. Mm-hmm. No such real thing as a dollar, but we agree so we can have exchanges with strangers. Okay. Now, there's new fictions arising, like followers, comments, and likes. But if we can't trust in these metrics, then we can no longer make, you know, business agreements. And so Instagram is undermining their own economy because if no one trusts in their currency, no one will do business there anymore or believe in what they see. You know, a couple of years ago was the year of fake news. Maybe this is the year of fake followers. And personally, I don't want to live in a world where I can't believe anything that I see. Mm-hmm. And especially in the visual realm, I mean, maybe our people are turned on now that news could be fake and you kind of should be watch all news and, you know, written text with the right eye. But when you see something, you see a physical picture, you know, of someone, you know, drinking a champagne in a bubble bath, looking at a beach, you're like, oh, this is real. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's not real. And it causes undue anxiety. It causes a lot of copycats. People are like, oh, that's not my life. I don't have that many followers. I'm a loser. When really a lot of it is based on fraud.
Right. And you highlight some of that stuff in your book. I think it's fascinating. You're showing how there's some accounts out there that, I mean, they just go and, like you said, they buy all these things, and but they're making real dollars. Like they go out to brands and they sell brands on this idea that they're going to get this big impact. And you showed where one big, you know, quote unquote, large Instagram user plugged a brand and it only resulted in what, like 25 additional followers for that brand or something.
Right.
Yeah. And it was just like, okay, like there's no way something has 20,000 comments and likes on it, but only picked up 25 followers. Like, I know that Wired had commissioned you to write an article about this. Are you going to point out some of this fraud, or what's your, I mean, obviously it'll come out in the book.
Yeah. Well, the original impetus of it is I brought this up when I was on the walk with Kevin Kelly. I said, hey man, I've been doing some research. And part of it was that I have kind of authority on the matter because one of our partners is the Ritz-Carlton. And I go around to a lot of Ritz-Carlton events. I do a lot of luxury travel events. And they pay quite a bit of money and give all this free stuff. And I've ended up sometimes, not necessarily at Ritz-Carlton, but other travel luxury events with these other influencers. And I'm like, what's going on? Because, like, as you know, I'm the same as you. I like to have like really deep, meaningful philosophical conversations right away. And maybe everyone doesn't have that kind of depth, but I just like to see like what's going on in your brain. And a lot of these influencers I met, there's like a hollowness or a lacking. I'm like, how are these people so popular? And then I would look at their followers and then I reverse engineered it. So I told Kevin, I said, this is a weird world we're living in. It's actually a bigger problem. He goes, let's talk to my editor at Wired. And he contacted me. So I wasn't actually commissioned, but we started down the process, okay? Mm. And I started accumulating all this data, and then I would share it with the editor. Then I ended up having just so much data. I'm like, hey, I'm just going to blow this thing up into a book because I figured a lot of stuff out.
Right.
Yeah, so that was the impetus for it.
Yeah, so this book is great for any brands that are looking to... I mean, I think that there's something very powerful about finding an influencer, a legitimate influencer, and getting them excited about your product and hopefully saying good things about you because it can drive a lot of, you know, downloads or purchases or whatever it may be. So you give people the tools to go in and really kind of reverse engineer these accounts and look for yourself and say, are these legitimate accounts? What about tactics for people that are listening right now that are like, listen, like Trey, like I'm a new photographer. I've got some, I consider these to be like 100 great photos that I have up here. How can they use some of these tools, or is there anything out there that they can do to grow their own following? Like, how does that, have you discovered anything that is legitimate that people can use?
It's very difficult. I think the two most important things are having a pretty photo, which in a lot of ways, you can really argue, Kevin, that everybody can take pretty photos nowadays. There's so many beautiful photos out there. That's no longer a differentiator. In fact, I'm not being, you know, self-deprecating or humble when I say I don't really feel like my photos are much better than a lot of other people's photos. But people do like to have a bit of a personality behind them and some storytelling that's a bit avant-garde or different. Because every photo is a gateway to a story that you can tell. And this is something I learned from Stephen Tobolowsky at an EG conference many, many years ago. Like, there is an art to storytelling. I always thought like other people are storytellers. You know, you watch great raconteurs up there and they tell these amazing stories like, wow, I wish I could tell stories like that. And you always think storytellers are other people, but this is something that anyone can learn. You know, you have an act one and an act two and an act three. And this kind of stuff is researchable. I won't go into it all now, but I think being a good storyteller is part of it. And that is also what really the second half of the book is about, is how, you know, not to have anxiety about all this stuff, not to let it get to you. We also talk about this mass delusional behavior, how this is the first time in history where you're actually actively seeking the approval of complete strangers. Hmm. We've always, you know, the Dunbar 150, right? There's 150 people that human brain keep track of. Used to be your Pleistocene village. Now it's your friends and family or whatever. But now, and you've always wanted the approval of these people, but now people base their self-worth on the approval of absolute strangers who will never have any material impact on their life. And this is a bad thing. There's studies in there that show how it's really bad for especially young women. There's been all these scientific studies that show how it increases anxiety. It makes people feel less attractive. So the whole idea of selfies. And there's this bad situation that's happening. So I think that's the number one thing for people that are starting these accounts, is don't fall into this trap of despair based on this false reality that appears to be happening. Now, hopefully, if all the good actors, which honestly, I think are 98%, 99% were good actors. I think if we can gang together and encourage Instagram to clean this stuff up for their own benefit, really, and for our benefit, because like what's going on right now is not good for them. Like, for example, there's this, have you heard of podding?
I have not. What is this?
This is very interesting. Okay. And this is what some of the most successful Instagram accounts do. Like, I would suggest podding to these people, but I find it to be unethical. Podding is you get together a group of 20 Instagrammers. This is like a small pod. Some pods have like 1,000 and they communicate offline using WhatsApp. Okay. And there's rules for these pods. It was fascinating. I found out all about these in doing the book because I knew a little bit about them. But what happens is you have an agreement. Like, whenever you put up a photo, you get on your WhatsApp group and you say like, hey, I'm at Trey Ratcliffe. I just put up a photo. Go for it. And then everyone within the pod, they're required within 5 or 10 minutes to go comment on your photo, give it a like. And people know the rules. Your comment has to be at least more than 3 words. You have to get in the first 10 minutes. And then if this happens, the Instagram algorithm knows like, hey, this is a super interesting photo. We're going to put this in more people's feeds. Because as you know, on Facebook or Instagram, your photo is only seen by like 1% of your followers,
right?
Because of their ridiculous algorithm that tries to maximize screen time so they can maximize advertising rather than maximizing people's lives. That's a whole nother thing. We won't get into.
You're a anti-algorithm, just you want them as they come in kind of guy, right?
Yeah. Chronological from people that I follow. You know, I would be glad to pay Instagram, you know, $5 a month to give me no advertising. Don't give me your algorithm. And everyone else that pays gets to see my stuff and I get to see their stuff. So anyway, when you're in a pod, suddenly your stuff is not seen by 1% of your followers. They might be seen by 10 or 50% of your followers. And if you don't behave the rules of the pod, right, you have to give back, right? It's this tit for tat type algorithm. You'll get kicked out of the pod. And so it's this kind of gulag situation. And also, I find this not as unethical as the other stuff I've been talking about, where you're actually trading fake bots for cash. But in this case, you're going to have a lot of people do this for brands. You know, like, let's say you're oh my gosh, I don't know. Like, there's lots of fashion pods out there too. So you're wearing this new, you know, whatever, $5,000 pair of shoes, and you put it out there like, look at these new amazing, you know, these shoes or whatever. And you get on your pod, and then immediately you have hundreds of people commenting on your shoes. That gets it way up the algorithm. And then you go back to the shoe company, you go like, oh man, thanks for sending me these shoes. This was a real hit. Keep sending me shoes.
Crazy.
But it, to me, it's not a lot different than bots or automatic scripts, because these are not genuine comments.
How do you find these pods?
There's a few ways to find them. One is Facebook. You can go on Facebook and search for pods. There's tons of them on there. Sometimes you just get invited to them. You talk to other people that appear to get a lot of comments and say like, hey, I love how much stuff you're getting. Are you part of a pod? Do you think I could join it? And they'll say yes, because now suddenly they're getting more guaranteed feedback. So they introduce you to the pod.
Crazy.
And Instagram, I've talked a lot with Instagram security. And
there's like no way to track that though, right? Like, how can you, because it's all done offline. Like, how do you actually crack down on that?
That's a good question. About 6 months ago, they came out a little anti-pod, because they know it's against their terms and conditions. And so they went on to Facebook, and they deleted like 10 pods that they saw. They're like, this is against our thing. But then I looked 3 months later, and if you just search for Instagram pods, you get over 100 results. So maybe they're playing whack-a-mole, or maybe they're just lazy, but now there's pods with just, you know, thousands and thousands of people in them that are all there. One way I think they could detect it, you know, putting on my math computer science hat, and I really don't know the interstices of what goes on inside Instagram security, but I think they could see certain network behavior, that if they see a group of 1,000 people or 500 people that have an inordinate amount of network traffic on each other's, they could look at this stuff. I think I kind of visualize it. Like, this is not normal behavior. You can see that these 500 people have this clustering of comments,
right?
This unnatural, inorganic behavior.
Yeah, we used to have to deal with this type of stuff at Dig as well, because people would go and dig stories and try and promote them to the front page. And one of the ways that we did it, you're absolutely right. What you do, at least that worked for us, and granted, this was like 10 years ago, but we would look at people that dug stories directly on the story versus going the natural way of finding it through a front page or on the up and coming section. So we would know that if there was no referral link and they were just landing directly there and going, that someone was sending that around because there was no natural path for them to get to that story any other way. So it'd be interesting to say, okay, because I would imagine if someone sends out a link, they're all going directly to that and just, you know, liking it and commenting right there versus, oh, the algorithm recommended it to me in the feed, and then I did my comment or like from the feed. You know, that's a different way of discovery. It's still very, I mean, the problem with this stuff is the second you implement something, people learn pretty quickly that you've now kind of like figured them out, and they find another way. And it's just, it is a crazy whack-a-mole.
So this goes back to your question. If you're on Instagram, you have a small business, whether you're a wedding photographer or you're a hairstylist. If you're not in a pod, you're at immediate disadvantage.
Ah, that's a brutal thing.
And it's too bad. But then again, I also think joining a pod is unethical, because when you're on a pod, dude, you got to be on your phone like 10 hours a day, because people are constantly posting photos. And if you're not responding within 10 minutes, you're out of the pod.
Oh, they kick you out.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of these megapods, they keep track. If there's no tit for tat, like if you're only receiving and not giving, you're out of there. So this ties you even more to a slave to your phone to produce this kind of interest. And
I'm too old for these games.
Yeah, it's not a good thing. Yeah. So I don't know. If Instagram doesn't clean it up, I mean, if you're not willing to engage in these what I consider to be disingenuous behaviors, then it's really very difficult for you.
Yeah. Well, it's cool that you're laying this all out there, because I've never seen, I've heard, you know, I've seen the buying followers. I actually found a site where you can buy followers, and I bought some for a friend just because I thought it was funny.
Yeah.
Which it is pretty hilarious, because
funny.
a buddy of mine had like 100 followers, and he woke up the next day and he had like, you know, 10,000 or something like that. And he was freaking out, and like, me and another friend were just like, dude, how are you doing it? Like, was one of your photos really popular? You know, and it was a joke. And it's it, this story, I mean, it's not worth sharing. Well, I'll tell you that we forgot to tell him that it was us. And yeah. It wasn't until a year later that we actually told him. And so he was just like,
God damn it, guys.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, you fuckers.
Yeah.
But anyway.
The other funny joke you play on your friends, I recommend that in the book too, is make these custom comments and do them on your friend's account.
Oh, that's a brilliant idea.
And like things that could kind of make sense, yes. But a little over the edge.
Yes. I mean, that's, I can see that that's a great use case for this stuff. Crazy. So, I mean, it sounds like everything that you have done has been obviously like being very early on, like in terms of your success and writing about stuff that was unique and kind of against the grain at the time. Like this idea of like sharing photos and giving them away without putting watermarks. This idea of using, you know, these Mars rover algorithms on their photos. Like, I feel like when I've met other friends that have built very massive followings, it is never because they did a Me Too thing. Like Me Too is, that's a horrible thing because it's tied to that movement now, but meaning they're not just copying someone's success. They're saying, what can I do that is truly unique and different? And running with that, and if that resonates with people, that's ultimately the best way to build a following.
I think that this is right. I mean, one reason I wrote this book, well, a few reasons, I'm not afraid. I have no fear. I have 170,000 on Instagram, and it doesn't you know, affect my income because it's all fine art. So I'm not dependent on it. So I can kind of be the canary in the coal mine. And I do want to help out other people that are struggling. And I think probably my best advice, not just on Instagram, but you know, generally in life, is to, you know, discover your true self. And that's not easy. It takes a long time. You know, it's taken us a long time. We're still finding it. But as you find your true self and you become more open-hearted and vulnerable, you start to tell your story. And you can tell your story through whatever your creative mechanism is. It doesn't matter if you're a landscape photographer or a hairstylist or you make pastries. Everyone has some kind of true calling that they just get obsessed with and they don't know why, and they don't necessarily do it for money, but you know, as long as they are enjoying it, they might as well try to find a way to, you know, make some kind of monetary vehicle out of it. And insofar as you're finding your true self, you find a way to talk about your calling and to talk about what you're doing and tell stories about your creations. And that really resonates with people. People know when they're listening to something genuine, something heartfelt from a creative because they find it inspirational and it realize it's not a zero-sum game. And there is an honesty to it because we see so much dishonesty out there. It kind of bleeds through in some of these hollow Instagram posts. You're like, come on, this isn't real. But people can sense realness. And you know, you might figure out in 3 months or 6 months or a year. But you know, I encourage people not just to focus on their own particular medium, whether it's a pastry chef or hairdressing, but have a wide cornucopia of interest. You know, read about history and philosophy and science and all this stuff, because as you read all these diverse subjects, it will inadvertently inform whatever your passion is. And you'll have a unique approach to making pastries that other people won't have. Mm-hmm. You will find your true self by giving yourself lots of, you know, visual and intellectual inputs, and it will change your mind. And you will have a unique mind, and then you will have your true calling. You'll find your true self, and then it's quite easy to communicate that. It's no longer a struggle.
Man, that is just sage advice right there. That's solid stuff. I feel like, yeah. I mean, I'm still trying to figure this out.
Me too.
I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. You know, it's like I've gone and done so many different things, but I will say that, you know, for me, I think this is my life. My life is to just explore and try different things. And I enjoy that. I enjoy the excitement around new objects. I am a little bit too attracted to, my wife calls it like the shiny object, like something will move and I'll be like, oh, what's that? You know, I got to get into that.
Right.
But you know, I like to make sauerkraut and I also like to meditate. And I also like, I just bought a book on doing stained glass.
Right.
I don't know why I bought that book. I was on Amazon one night and it like came up in front of me. I'm like, ooh, I'd like to do some kind of like crazy stained glass project. It's weird, but like, I think that's part of like just exploring and poking around. I don't know. At least for me, that's always been Some of the most exciting things that I've done have always been just kind of like these random little dabblings. And then when you find something that you really get excited about, you can go really deep on it. But trying a bunch of things, I think, is been
I think that's important thing. Too. And, you know, I was using fairly specific examples like making pastries or hairdressing. But, you know, your true calling, I think, is obviously an explorer and a curator of cool stuff, a curator of conversations. These are unusual skills that you've developed, but you're really good at it. And this idea of trying a lot of stuff is, I agree, totally important. Keep doing it because you can have many interests in life. And you know, if you channel your kids, you have kids, you know, they try new stuff all the time. One week it's skateboarding. Yeah. The next week it's electric guitar. And they don't mind. They just put the skateboard in the corner like, it wasn't for me. But as grownups, we're so serious. Like, you need to do one. Like, and also this whole institutionalized educational system has kind of fucked us up. Like, you're meant to do one thing with your life. And that's a very old way of thinking. You know, we're incredibly plastic. We can do so many things in our life and try a lot of stuff. Find out what you're passionate about. You never know. And then just get into it and do a deep dive until it no longer serves you and set it aside the way Marie Kondo would do. And then do another passion.
You know? Yeah. That's great advice. What do you think? Well, actually, you know, we should just talk about, because we talked about it yesterday a little bit. Let's just dive into psychedelics for a second.
Okay. Let's do it.
Because speaking of kind of like trying new stuff and mind altering things, I think you and I are in the same camp in that I didn't really touch any of this stuff until much later in life. And I never had the intention for me to, well, I guess my intention was to, how can I use these as tools? That said, you know, certainly my first time doing mushrooms a few years ago was just like, let's have fun with it, you know, but like now I'm seeing so much application of these things to really break down the ego and expand the mind in creative ways. Mm-hmm. You've been a long time Burning Man fan and have gone for many years and have some great photos from Burning Man, by the way. We looked at those last night. What have you learned? What have you learned? You've taken first time people, you've seen people experiment with this stuff. Like, what does this add to your sense of self and then also your creativity? Has it impacted your creativity, this idea of these different psychedelic compounds?
Absolutely. I give a lot of credit to these mind expanding substances to expand my mind. You know, that's why they're called that. I've only experimented with them for the last 5 years. Probably when I was, you know, 41, 42. I think that's kind of an interesting time.
And you didn't drink before that either, right?
No, not until I moved to New Zealand about 6 years ago. Yeah.
You were like straight edge hardcore. Was there any religious reason behind that or what was?
No, not really. The reasons for not drinking are not, you know, interesting or insightful. I'll give you the brief reason. One, you know, my dad was an alcoholic. He died about 6 months ago.
Oh, 6 months. I'm sorry to hear that. Oh, I didn't know it was that soon.
No, it's okay. We, and I know you had some dad issues. I feel lucky I didn't have any, you know, he loved me and respected me and vice versa. So it was all good there. I spoke at his eulogy and stuff. And that was nice. And it wasn't the alcohol that killed him. It was a wide variety of things. He was a race car driver and all kinds of things, but it did cause problems. And I thought, oh man, why would I want to cause problems in my life? And then, you know, I was like a clever kid, you know, with math and computers and stuff. And then I thought, why would I ever want to diminish my cleverness? That's illogical. And then when I moved to New Zealand, it's kind of like a drinking culture. You know, they just like don't have water sometimes. There's only wine around. I was like, okay. And then I realized that control is overrated. You know, control all the time is overrated. And I found that it did, you know, decrease my super active mind so that my creative mind could unleash a little bit. Mm. So I thought, oh, it's not so bad. And also, like, I think my dad was a little bit of a sad drinker, you know, he had issues but I'm not, I'm a happy guy, you know, I don't have sadness at these times, so it doesn't seem to cause any problems in that regard. So then that kind of opened up. Then I was going to Burning Man and I enjoyed it. You know, I think I've been 8 years in a row. The first 2 years, I didn't even drink or do drugs or anything. I was just like, wow, this is great. And then on the advice of some very smart intellectual people, they said, Trey, you have such a creative mind. I think this will do something for you. I was like, okay. I was a little scared, but then I did it And then once again, I saw there was nothing to be scared of. And
what did you do? What was that experience?
First time was mushrooms. And, you know, I would go around, I would look at the lights and listen to the music. And I realized that it kind of removed some filters that the human brain puts into place.
That's
just so
a
you get
through the day. Great way to put it.
Yeah. And I wasn't hallucinating, you know, I wasn't going to run out into traffic, get run. I was totally in control. In fact, I would say way more in control than alcohol. You know, I could ride a bike, have communications, but the things I would see, I'd be like, wow. And I consider myself a fairly, I'm good at visuals, you know, I'm into super dynamic, colorful things. But the things I saw, especially when you close your eyes, I would be like, wow, what is going on? And I just found it to be like intellectually stimulating. And then I found, because you know, these experiences only last 5 or 6 hours and then you're back to normal. But I found that it opened up rooms in my mind that I can revisit anytime.
Mm.
And you have perfect memory of these events as opposed to like dreams can sometimes be kind of trippy, right? You have, we all have weird dreams. And, but you kind of forget about it the next day. But this stuff I have pretty much perfect memory of.
Give me an example of when you say, because I love to like really dig in, and there's going to be a certain subset, probably a lot of people that are listening to this podcast, they're like, okay, you guys are druggies and crazy. I've never done this before. What do you mean when you say open up rooms? What is that actually? I know a lot of this stuff is so difficult to put into words because like we don't have words for certain feelings. What is a room and how does it get open?
It is. It does speak to this ineffable nature of these substances. But I think everyone thinks about their brain a different way. I think about mine as this little dollhouse, you know, and when it comes time for me to go make some food, I go into my little kitchen in my dollhouse and I open my little recipe book in my brain. When it comes time for me to go out on a jog, I go into my little sports room. Or whatever. I've always had my techie room and all these kind of things. But then there's these other kind of sub rooms or like additions to rooms where you just get so much more. It's like a you know, installing some kind of bad idea. But like you're in your art room and now suddenly you've installed a lava lamp. You're like, wow, that's pretty interesting. And it gives you a little bit of stimulation. And it adds in a lot of ways, especially when I started adding LSD. Not at the same time, but when I added this to the list of hallucinogens that I imbibe, it has shown me how incredibly beautiful and wonderful the universe is and kind of how silly the universe is and how lucky I am to be a part of it. And I do see this wonderful tapestry of consciousness, how we're all really connected and we're all in this together. And it's made me understand even more the answer to everything is love. And this is not, it's a real deep, spiritual thing that it is totally real. I kind of sensed this was true, but this confirmed it was true.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made me more, bold. It's made me less apologetic. I have less fear in my life. And I think this is important for creatives to have less fear. Now, having said that, I think it's important for creative. Like I say, I'm 75% full of self-doubt, and I'm 75% positive and confident in myself. I think this is a healthy balance and hasn't adjusted that percentage. But like now, when I look at the world, I see things a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
I see trees differently. Mm-hmm. I see the sky differently. I see the mountain differently.
Yes.
And there's almost this vibration that maintains itself after these events.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very connected to people and nature. And so now as I've always enjoyed walking around landscapes, that's mostly what I do. And I've always felt kind of connected, but now I feel really connected. And it's very peaceful. It's very mindful. My mind is sort of a tabula rasa. It's, you know, as I do more and more meditation, you know, I understand this fundamental concept that you're not the thoughts in your head. You're the silence behind the thoughts. You can watch them go by. You can think of thoughts like clouds. You know, you watch clouds go by and you never go like, that's an ugly cloud. That's a misshapen, ugly cloud. You're like, oh, just a cloud. And so you start to think about your thoughts like that. You don't think, oh, that's a bad thought. That's a good thought.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, oh, it's just a thought. Isn't that interesting how that kind of thought goes by. And it does give you this intellectual perspective on consciousness that has informed my art. It's made me, I was already not a judgy person at all. It's made me even less judgy. And I am not hard on myself anymore. And I just try to create and with my creations, love as much as possible and hopefully gently push people towards this consciousness. Because as you kind of ramp up this consciousness ramp, you know, look, I'm no Buddha or anything. He's way above me, but there's probably even more above that. But then you can look back and see people that are unconscious and full of anxiety and full of fear, and their life is not fully realized. And, but you do it, you look at it in not a judgy way, like, oh, look how, you know, evolved I am and how unevolved. It's not like that at all. It's actually one of the great things. It's not, you accept them as they are, but you also kind of gently want to pull them in this direction, you know? So all of my experiences have taught me that there is a flowering of human consciousness, and we're flowers, and we kind of want to, you know, gently germinate this idea, this world-changing idea. And again, this sounds terribly solipsistic, and I have this sort of mission that I think it's up to artists and creatives to save the world. I don't think the governments can do it. And so I think that we're all kind of on to something, and that we can work together and network together, and we can really move the needle on the world.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And it's tough for me because I have family members and other friends actually that are so, you know, we've been told our entire lives, like, these are drugs. You are doing drugs. Like, and how like heavy that feels, you know? And certainly I would say that I'm sure that you and I agree that there are compounds out there that are very addictive and 100%
right.
should be avoided.
Yeah, like, no opioids, no heroin, yeah, none of that stuff.
We're not talking about that type of
not
stuff.
Not all drugs are the same.
Right, no. Right. Yeah. It's So it's hard for me to have those conversations with those folks about these, but it is getting easier. I will say that when John Hopkins and some of these other universities are doing these stage 3 trials with mushrooms, the same stuff that, you know, that you can take at Burning Man on cancer patients that are facing end of life, and it completely removes anxiety, gets them comfortable with passing away. Like, no one can argue that that's an amazing, very positive thing to help these people. And if these tools can help people like that, I think that it's just like, why not? Like, it's so much better than leaning on painkillers or benzos like Xanax and things like that we know are extremely addictive. Oftentimes, a lot of these treatments are done one time. Like, I've done high dose mushrooms exactly one time. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that was an amazing life-changing experience for me. It's been many years since I've done it now. And I think that, you know, I could see myself doing it again in the future, no doubt. But this, it's not addictive by any means. If anything,
right.
It's really a lot of work.
I was afraid of being addicted too, but they're not addictive.
No, I mean, they've proven so many times, like both in rats and humans, that these aren't addictive substances. But I like your initial description around the removal of filters.
Mm.
Because one of the things that I noticed when trying this stuff is that if you think about how you were, and especially having a 1 month or 1 year, 2 month-year old little girl, if you think about how you were when you were a child, I used to like lay in the dirt and like look at rocks. And I would like hold a rock, and I watch Zelda. She will pick up anything around the house, like a piece of lint. She'll see a piece of lint on the ground and just like pick it up. And then she'll sit there and look and study that lint for like 3 to 5 minutes.
Right.
And you're just like, I'm watching her do this, and I'm just like, wow, she is like into that piece of lint.
Yeah.
She doesn't have all the emotional baggage of years of trauma and having to figure out how to pay the bills and like all these other things that close us off to that kind of like childlike nature and that add these filters on us over time. For her, that thing right then and there is the most important thing in her universe. And when you go and you do these types of substances, lint gets really interesting
yeah,
again.
It does.
You know? And you realize, oh my God, I'm a child again. I can look at things fresh through child's eyes, through childlike eyes. And that comes to tree bark and trees and nature and the universe and everything else. And you can get a glimpse to that state, that childlike state that we all remember how amazing it felt to be a child and like jump out of bed and go out and play and like just like dig in the dirt and all those things.
Yep.
You go right back there. And it's a beautiful thing to be reminded that you can get there. And you can also then go back there. And like you said, you can revisit these rooms without having to be on these substances. And you can also get there through meditation as well and like calm the mind down to experience some of that very mindfulness around objects, which I think is such a beautiful thing to be reminded through these compounds that we can get back to that childlike state.
I think that's a great thing to have kids and be experimenting on meditation and psychedelics at the same time, because you do see this, because, you know, before the age of 5 or 6, they don't really develop an ego. They don't develop the intellectual, you know, scaffolding to be able to categorize things. Like we categorize things, you know, like there's a tree, there's a lint, there's a pillow. Done.
Yeah.
You know, I'm done. I already categorized it. Good job, brain.
And it's good or bad.
Yeah.
It's good pretty or not pretty.
Yeah.
Like there's so many labels that we apply to everything.
Right. And, you know, I would recommend to anyone that's remotely interested, or even if you're skeptical, to listen to your podcast with Michael Pollan.
Yes.
And hopefully that is a gateway to actually read his book called How to Change Your Mind, because he's a true skeptic about this stuff. And he talks about the history of it all. And insofar as you and your family, you get pushback from your family or friends on some of this stuff. And I did wonder, like, how did this stuff get out of fashion? And he makes many cases in there. And one of them is from a, you know, religious thing, in that if you can use these substances, which, by the way, 99% of our ancestors used before, you know, modern urbanization and this kind of stuff and modern religion. If you have direct access to the spirit realm and have divine experiences, and I say that without any particular religion in mind, then what role does the church play?
It's called cutting out the middleman.
Yeah, the church is there to mediate your path. If you want to access the divine, you need to use this template for your life. And if you follow our rules, then maybe you'll get to heaven, but you better listen to us. Mm-hmm. And also, no drugs. And, you know, maybe give us some money. And it's sort of like this weird institution that you can make a strong claim has caused a lot of death and suffering in the world and has inadvertently caused a lot of anxiety by removing some of these natural substances that our ancestors have imbibed forever, as they get in the way and they become some sort of power structure that you have to adhere to. So that's one of many reasons it fell out of favor. Another great reason in there that he talks about is during the Vietnam War, and it, like, unfortunately, all this interesting stuff that started to make a revival then got caught up in this, you know, anti-war movement. And then Nixon was like, oh, we got to get rid of this stuff. And so it's just kind of, it's had some bad luck along the way, but now it's making a resurgent, not amongst everybody, but I think that what's great is there's so many intellectuals, well-accomplished people, not that it means anything to be wealthy, but wealthy, accomplished people are talking about this kind of stuff. And, you know, they're not kooks. They're very persuasive. So I think it's a long battle. I think we have, you know, very rational arguments. We're very rational people. You know, we have our lives on the rails. And I think slowly we can move the needle on this too, because I agree. Ultimately, I think it'll be good for people. It's better than using these Xanax and these opioids.
In a really horrible way. And I say this like not joking at all, like opioids it's such a travesty what's happened with those compounds, but they also are actually helping this movement in a weird way, because we know that is a serious problem that we need to treat. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Iboga and some of these other crazier psychedelics that people with these addictions will go into, and they'll go down to these facilities that do this down in Mexico or other places, and they can go in for these treatments, which are very scary and pretty severe. But when you are going to die from a heroin overdose or whatever it may be, you'll do anything to, you know, rewire the brain. Mm. And they can come out of these experiences not wanting to touch the stuff again. And there is no other solution, really.
Right.
And it's amazing that these natural compounds are able to do that.
Well, I think we kind of convince people one at a time. I think you can do more than one at a time with your awesome platform here. But a good example is my stepmom. Okay. She's been in a real funk since my dad died 6 months ago. You know, she, you know, really loved him and they were very, you know, this sort of thing. So she'd been very sad because she took care of him for so long while he was so sick. And so she's kind of been hooked on Xanax and all this stuff. And it's sort of a numbing thing. She doesn't like it. She doesn't know what to do. And so I brought this up to her. I said, hey, you know, listen to this podcast, read this book. If you're interested in trying one of these psychedelic experiences, I have a counselor. And I think this is one thing that most people don't realize is that you're not just going out into like a rave and doing acid and suddenly you're cured. That's not how it is. You go into a counseled situation, like with a professional, and it's a nice room, you know, with a couch.
Put an eye mask on, like
you're going right down some intentions.
You're doing work here. Yeah.
And they take care of you, do an inward dive, and the studies are just undeniable. It will fix that problem. She wants to do it. She said,
oh,
yes.
Wow.
So I kind of think this one at a time thing. And then if it works for her, which I think it will, then she'll talk to some of her friends and say like, hey, you know, I was on this stuff. Was it working for me? I tried this thing. It's innovative. Here's some studies. Why don't you try it? So I think it can slowly spread word of mouth like that, just from firsthand experience.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I'm really excited for the phase three trial stuff. I'm hoping this gets approved. I know it's on the Oregon ballot coming up here to make this something that can be done in kind of a therapist type setting on the mushroom front. So we'll see what happens there. But well, Trey, I know you got to catch a plane here shortly, and I want to thank you so much for everything that you do and for being here and for sharing all this stuff. And there's two questions I have. One, I want to thank you for allowing me to put that video of Alan Watts into the Oak Meditation app, which was a lot of people really enjoyed. Can I play that at the back end of this? Or we can send people to go in the show notes. We can send people to go watch it because I think it's a really great video that you put together.
Yeah, you can do the audio version, which is pretty nice.
The video one is a little better too. Yeah, the video that you edited to go along with that is awesome. But I want to get people to check out your book because I think there's so many really cool tools in that book for people that are trying to do positive things with their Instagram following, not just people that are looking for fraud, but there's a lot of resources and things that you get into there and certainly how to manage the anxiety around a lot of this stuff. It should be out by the time this podcast is released. So where can people go and buy it? Just search on Amazon.
So you can get it right in your Kindle or you can have it printed and mailed to your house. It's a physical book too. Yeah. Get one, get a few for your friends.
Awesome.
Yeah. And let me know your feedback because I'm a big fan of conversations like you're doing and, you know, Sam Harris is doing. And I wanted this book to be like the beginning of a conversation, not the alpha to omega of everything you need. Cause mm-hmm. I think it raises a good conversation. Like what should Facebook be doing? What should Instagram be doing? What can we all do together? So, you know, I guess coincidentally, I started a Facebook group for this, and it's inside the book. And so as you read it, as you have any thoughts, come join the group, join the conversation, because I want to hear your feedback. What do you think? Because I think we're really all in this together.
Yeah, awesome. Cool. Well, I'm excited for it to come out. I was looking over your shoulder when you were going through it on your laptop, but I want to get a physical copy as well. But awesome, Trey. Well, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you very much. Next time I come back, we'll talk more about drugs. We'll get into MDMA, 2CB, smoking the toad, all kinds of stuff.
The toad I'm scared of.
We'll start simple with these hallucinogens, and then we'll ramp it up and see what else is out there.
Awesome. Well, thank you, sir. All right, that is it for this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, the number one thing you can do is head on over to the iTunes store where the podcasts live. Do search for The Kevin Rose Show and give us a 5-star review. That helps our podcast get recommended to more people. And when more people see it, I get even better guests for the show. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.